Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel talk show on multiple myeloma. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talk, and along with the Cure Talk team of Sharib Khan and Chintan Patel, I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on multiple myeloma. We will be moderating the call and bringing people live on the show. Cure Talk is excited to announce that this is our sixth Cure Panel on myeloma, and our broadcasts have received over 25,000 replays. Cure Talk will continue to conduct myeloma panels, and we encourage myeloma advocates, patients, and bloggers to co-host the show with us. The Myeloma Cure Panel talk show for the month of March has been scheduled for the 20th of March 2013. We're also very happy to announce that March will see the Cure Panel talk show platform host its first show on prostate cancer. The show would have an international panel, and for more details of our forthcoming Cure Panel discussions, please visit Cure Talk website at trialx.com/curetalk. Today's Cure Panel is very unique. It is dedicated to answering questions on living with myeloma. On the panel, we have experienced and informed myeloma survivors who will answer questions based on their experience with their myeloma diagnosis. Listeners are requested to remember that the panelists are myeloma survivors and are not doctors. Hence, please avoid questions asking for clinical advice. Today's Cure Panel talk show on multiple myeloma is co-hosted by Pat Killingsworth, who is a noted author, blogger, and myeloma survivor. Welcome to the show, Pat. Supporting him on the panel, we have editor, MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson, blogger, musician, myeloma survivor, Nick Van Dyke, and support group leader, myeloma survivor, Sandy Hirsch. On behalf of Cure Talk and Cure Panel, I extend a hearty welcome to the panelists. I extend my welcome to everyone who is listening to the panel discussion. Before I hand over to Pat, there are a few rules which would make your Cure Panel experience smooth. If you're listening in to the panel through your phone as well as a computer, please mute or stop the online broadcast on your computer for better audio quality. Callers will be invited to ask questions at the end of the discussion. They can let us know by pressing 1 on their keypads and we will bring them online live. Pat would now introduce us to the panelists. Pat, you're live on air.
Hi, Priya. Before we get started, could I ask you a question?
Yeah?
When we get to the end, we had those late questions come in by email. How many of us can be on the line at once?
I think more than one, definitely. But they can let us know by pressing 1, Pat, and we will bring them alive. If you want more than one person on the show, just let me know, and I'll unmute all of them.
Sounds good. When we get there, I know that's sort of burying the lead, but welcome, everybody.
Sure.
And I'm excited to be hosting Cure Talk tonight. We have a great panel. Gary Peterson, Nick Van Dyke, and a friend of mine from North Carolina, Sandy Hirsch. Runs a support group up there. So I think what we'll do, the way we'll operate, is we'll each take maybe 4 or 5 minutes, talk a little bit about our background, some of our strengths, and then we've had over 20 questions emailed to us. We've had a chance to look them over ahead of time, and we sort of divvy them up, and each one of us are going to answer 3 or 4 of those questions. Then I was just asking Priya about some questions that were latecomers that weren't assigned, that I just wondered if I could look through them and assign a panelist, or a panelist could volunteer to answer some of those. But before we get to that, let's have our panelists introduce ourselves. I guess I'll start. I have 4 myeloma-related blogs, multiple myeloma blogs, .com is I blog there daily, and there's a little bit of everything, some about me, but more about research exciting new therapies. We feature a number of different stories from survivors, inspirational stories, that type of thing. Then my wife and I do helpwithcancer.org, and on there, that's more nutrition, lifestyle, with a broader scope. I also run something called mylomanews.com, and that's where I shouldn't use the word dump. That's where I put research, subclinical trials, things that the general reader, myeloma patients, or a caregiver off the street might not be interested in, and they can get that information there. And then I also run a site called cancernews.com, which is actually, I'm sorry, it's cancernews.us. And that's just a general cancer information. So the first three, I think, are myeloma-related. I do a monthly column for the Myeloma Beacon. And I've written four books about multiple myeloma. I was diagnosed in 2007. I was able to put off a transplant for 4 years. Just Revlimid and dexamethasone, and dropped the dex after a couple, year and a half maybe. And I had a transplant 20 months ago now, and came through that fine. Didn't have quite the response we hoped, but it did help press a reset. Revlimid, which had stopped working, was now resensitized and has been working for me. And so I'm doing okay, and it enables me to volunteer and help out and do what I do. Next, we have Gary Peterson. Gary, could you tell us a little bit about your story and what you do?
Sure, Pat, and thank you very much. And I must say that Pat and Nick have two of the best blogs that I've seen and websites on the Internet that are informative for myeloma patients. I have one as well. You know, my story is probably everybody has one when you get multiple myeloma. You know, mine was I had a wonderful life, wife and child, and was a successful executive and was preparing to go on a visit to see my brand new granddaughter. And then I found that Then all of a sudden, here I am. How do I end up with end-stage dialysis-dependent kidney failure? Well, 2 days prior to this time, I was doing some yard work and just felt a little tired and drained, and later took my blood pressure at a local pharmacy, and it was high for the first time in my life, and my wife was a little concerned and cajoled me into going to a local doctor. And as I'm getting ready to go see my granddaughter after that, the doctor called with the results of the tests and said, Gary, get to the emergency room immediately because you are in kidney failure. And so this is how me and my family's journey began. And it was, I was fortunate enough to be able to be treated by the folks from Mayo Clinic and then later had two stem cell transplants at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences at UAMS in Little Rock. And how did I get from Mayo, Jacksonville, to UAMS? Well, for one thing, my daughter happens to be an editor for the Wall Street Journal and was on the health desk, so she did a lot of research for me. And I did research as well, and we found out that the data, little that was available at the time, that the 3-year life expectancy at Mayo was, or the life expectancy at Mayo was 3 years, and at UAMS was 7 years. So I chose at that time to go for the additional life, if you want to call it that. And so it served me well. I've been in complete remission for 7 years. I still remember reading the publication from UMS that read about people like me. It said, of the 950 patients with dialysis-dependent kidney failure, the average life expectancy is 3 months. And that was me. So as you can imagine, it put the fear of God in me. And I do feel blessed just to be alive and to have the success so far that I have. And I'm now off of all chemo meds, off of dialysis, and I'm as close to near normal as I can be. Now, I developed the because of my experiences, I developed my website, which is www.myomosurvival.com, and I did it for a number of reasons. Early on in my research, like I said, we looked at the data, and there was next to nothing on the internet. We would do searches like myeloma, multiple myeloma survival rates, and we would come up with pretty much nothing at all. And as a result, I felt that we needed additional information to make good, solid decisions for my family, but also for all myeloma patients. So that's why I started myelomasurvival.com. And so, yes, I am on a mission, and my mission is to help save life. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Thanks, Pat.
Well, thank you, Gary, and thanks for all you do. A friend of mine, Nick Van Dyke, from out in California. Nick, are you here with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Sure can. I Googled you the other day, and that's sort of a wild ride.
I've got it. I have a dual life. So,
go ahead.
Quickly, my story. I'm was relatively young when I was diagnosed. I had just turned 40 a couple months prior, and I had a tiny pain in my shoulder that I attributed to turning 40, and I thought I was going to have to go see a chiropractor, which I apologize to any chiropractors on the line. I thought was one step ahead of seeing a witch doctor. But I then went to get my cholesterol checked at my regular physicians, and he said, oh, would you mind running this one other test? And so I did, and he said, well, your cholesterol's kept in check by this Lipitor, but you've got multiple myeloma, and you've got 3 to 5 years to live. And I was rather stunned because I was completely asymptomatic other than this little tingling in my shoulder, which turned out to be a focal lesion. I was fortunate that I was diagnosed by accident, unlike a lot of people that experience, you know, kidney damage or a broken rib or something like that. And I went to a diagnosing hematologist out here in Beverly Hills who told me that there was a wide range of opinion on how the disease could be treated. And he said, you've got, you know, probably 6 months to a year before it advances to the point of needing treatment, so take your time and do your research. So I spoke with, you know, half a dozen centers across the country, ranging from those that are more conservative at the time in their treatment to those that are more aggressive, with UAMS being the most aggressive at the time. And the only thing that wasn't aggressive was the assessment of how quickly my myeloma was developing, because I probably should have started treatment immediately. As it was, I began treatment a couple months later in February of 2009 at UAMS, where I underwent what they call Total Therapy 4, which is their treatment for patients that they designate as low risk based on an analysis of their bone marrow. That's about 85% of newly diagnosed patients that they see. And as part of that protocol, I went through one cycle of multi-agent chemotherapy, two consecutive stem cell transplants, another cycle of multi-agent chemotherapy, and then 3 years of maintenance therapy on Velcade, Revlimid, and Dex. And we sort of speak about these terms as though we're very familiar with them, so I'm sure there'll be an opportunity in follow-up questions to explain what we mean by all the shorthand. But that's essentially where I am now. I'm now off everything except the Velcade. The Revlimid, I think Pat had a melanoma from it, or at least that it could have been responsible for. I had a skin cancer in my finger that I believe was probably not helped by being on Revlimid, shall we say. But other than that, I've had a relatively easy go of it post-transplant. I've been in complete remission for almost 4 years, and you know, feel pretty darn good, all things considered. So that's where I'm at. And I guess I should just add, I also have a blog. It's the not very inventively named www.nvdmyeloma.blogspot.com.
Can you repeat that? I think at least on
yeah,
my end
so
it broke
some,
up.
Some interference here. It's www.nvd, Nick Van Dyke, my initials, myeloma.com, .blogspot.com, sorry.
Thanks, Nick. And it's nice both Nick and Gary Peterson have gone through total therapy, and it's great to have your insight in case that comes up.
You got finally five transplants between the three of us so far on this call.
Yeah. And I don't know if Priya can do anything about that. I'm not quite sure why we're getting the interference. All right, let's try. Sandy, I met Sandy Hirsch when I traveled up to Charlotte, North Carolina, to speak to a sport group there that she helps run. And I was just...
Pat, I'm having difficulty hearing you. This is Sandy. Hello?
Sandy, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Yes, I can.
Yeah, Gary. This is Gary Peterson. If you could do the same thing, provide provide your background while we're trying to get Pat back online.
All right, that'll be fine. I'm very honored to be part of this panel, and I'm going to add my stem cell transplant to all of yours. But as I said, my name is Sandy Hirsch. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina. And in 2008, I was already in the care of my hematologist-oncologist for chronic anemia, and I was going in every 2 weeks for iron. All of a sudden, I had this terrible hip pain, and it was so severe, I couldn't raise my leg. The doctor ran some further tests and a bone marrow biopsy, and with all that, I was diagnosed in August 2009 with multiple myeloma, and at that time, my M-spike was 3.5. He explained to me what I had because never had heard of it, like most of you. Then I went on to have 6 rounds of Revlimid, Velcade, and Dex, and that got me down to a number where they could do my stem cell transplant at Duke Medical Center in Durham. I had that done June of 2010. I didn't have a hard time afterwards, the fatigue, the not eating, all of that. But when remission finally came down to 0-0 and there was no evidence of myeloma, it only lasted 4 months for me. But I've been lucky because I haven't had any bone involvement and no other organs involved. It turned out I had a plasmacytoma on the lower part of my spine, and that was causing the pain. And through the RVD and the stem cell transplant, that totally shrunk up. I did get colon cancer last year. It was successfully removed in March of 12, and no further treatment was needed. Currently, I'm on Velcade only, and I feel the best I have felt in 3 years. I'm exercising, and I know that with multiple myeloma, there's always room for improvement. Thank you.
Well, Sandy, I'm back.
Hey, Pat, don't want to lose you.
I'm glad you were there talking. That's great. It's nice to hear from you again.
Thank you. I did forget to say, as you alluded to earlier, that yes, and I think I will in my other questions, but yes, my husband and I did start the multiple myeloma support group here, sponsored by the International Myeloma Foundation, because there was nothing to help us other than what the IMF would do at various locations. So it's been a godsend to our other patients and to us, and it's been the best thing I've ever done is start a support group. So now I really am through.
It is. It's, bless your heart. It's wonderful. And by the way, I'm on Velcade and dexamethasone. I'm also on Dex, and I feel great. So this
great. I'm so glad. I do not take Dex. I have brittle diabetes, which means that they don't know for what reason my sugar goes up and down. I can't take Dex.
Sure. Gotcha. Well, let's jump into these questions, everybody. And what I'd like to propose to make it easier technically is let each panel member answer their assigned question. So we're not jumping back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So I'll start, I guess, and I'll answer my questions. And then, Nick, you'd answer 3, 5, and 0.9, and we'll go that way. I'll remind you. But all right, so Connie, her question. Speaking of Dex, Fanny,
yeah.
Do many people not take Dex because of side effects? And if so, what are some of them experiencing? And you described one of yours being sort of a unique situation. And unfortunately, let me just start by saying, and reminding everyone we're not physicians, but Dex enhances every single myeloma therapy. So myeloma therapy goes better with Dex, would be the jingle, I guess. And it can be hard. We have in our support groups, we have people complain that their husband, they're ready to kick their husbands out the door or wives because they're so ornery and it can be difficult sleeping. It can be hard on your blood sugar, of course. I eat a very low-carb diet to help with those blood sugar swings. So it's not an unusual situation, but it's hard. Chemotherapy is hard, and at some point I think all of us have to take Dex.
Excuse me, Pat, could you speak a little louder? We are unable to hear you. Maybe a little bit closer to the phone.
Is this better?
Yeah, this is better, Pat.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, how about this? Is this better, Priya?
Yeah. Much better.
All right, I'll put her on speaker. The next question I was going to answer from Sheldon. How dangerous is sugar? And does that include starches like potatoes? He knows about the Mediterranean diet. But his cake, cookies, Coke, completely verboten. And it's interesting that Brian Dury, medical director of the IMF, rarely do myeloma doctors get involved with nutrition. It always seems to stay at arm's length. But Brian Dury has finally revealed in a number of blog posts on the IMF website that he believes sugar is a problem and it should be avoided. So the last time I was at an IMF event, they do not serve soda. Actually, soda of any kind, sugar or no sugar. I think the rule of thumb should be minimize it as much as you can, but that's probably the case for all of us. If it's a problem with Dex and with blood sugar swings, of course, you have to be a little more careful. But, you know, everybody, we can't sit there and feel sorry for ourselves and eat half a chocolate cake. But, we don't want to be dead before we get there. So I don't think a cookie or a Coke every other, a Diet Coke every other day or something is really going to hurt us. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And I'll end. I know Elliot from San Diego. He started a support group out there. And he asked a question, a good question, about steroids and the amount of people developing avascular necrosis. Some of us might have heard of necrosis of the jaw, but you can get necrosis in your hip, different joints, your shoulders. And he asked to please comment on helpful ways to avoid getting it. And I did a little research, and it's interesting. 6% of the general population will develop some type of necrosis in their lifetime. 9% of myeloma patients will develop it, so about 3% more. And as far as tips, men are at more risk, and dexamethasone can be a problem with that. But as far as helpful tips on ways to avoid it, unless Elliot has a sex change and doesn't use dexamethasone, I'm sorry, but I don't have an answer for you. And on that, maybe not helpful, but educational note, let me turn things over to Gary. And Gary, maybe you could answer your question.
Yes, Richard Whitaker. Asked a question. I have been diagnosed with CMML type 1. Are there any clinical trials that are running near San Jose, California? Are there any discussion sites for this rare form of leukemia online? And I just wanted to talk about this one in a very general sense, because Richard, you happen to have a type of cancer that is even far more rare than ours. We thought we were the chosen, but yours happens to be 15 times rarer than ours. There are actually three sites that I saw that have clinical trial information, one of which happens to be the Cure panel or Cure Talk site, Trial X, if you look online for that. But if you email me at editor@myelomasurvival.com, I'll send you those three sites. So email me at editor@myelomasurvival.com. There's none that I saw near San Jose. However, I can send you that information. You may look at, you were asked about if there's sites about information. You may look on acor.org. I looked on their site. Because of the rarity of yours, there's a lot of them, like MDS, which is they used to consider CMML part of MDS, and they have a website. And there's also other leukemia website, you know, support groups on that website that you can find. So I would go there. Now, the one thing I did want to let you know, that just like us, sometimes the best places aren't where you're living, and unfortunately, you know, San Jose is not a center for CMML research. And what I did find is that three locations in this country that seem to be good at it are at Moffitt, the Cleveland Clinic, and at MD Anderson. And specifically, Moffitt seems to really have their act together with regard to this particular type of cancer. So that's my read on that one. And sorry that you're confronted with such a rare, rare disease. I also found out that chemotherapy, former use of chemotherapy, can give you this. So as a result, you know, many, many myeloma patients may end up with this, just like they may end up with MDS. Excuse me. All right, Justin Nachman, does regular blood work show remission, or are these... or other means for tracking it, or are there other means for tracking it? And specifically, Justin, regular blood work will not show that you are in remission. What I think you mean by regular, I think you mean the CBC, or complete blood count, which is usually what people get when they go in for blood work. This is a blood test used to evaluate kind of your overall health and detect a wide range of disorders, including anemia, infection, that kind of thing. It can tell you if you're in. It cannot tell you if you're in remission. For that, you need what's called a light chain test, which can be ordered. It's a blood test as well, but it has to be ordered special. You can also get another test called an M protein test, and that'll determine whether it's in your blood or urine, and or a bone marrow biopsy. So myeloma patients, however, often show anemia and low platelets, which will show up in the CBC count. So that you know you can find out it through a blood test, I believe, but you know, not a typical CBC kind of blood test. Now, Kate, you asked about data, and this kind of one was very close to my heart. You said, why is the data that is hopefully being collected at each major myeloma clinic not available? I do not mean personal information, of course. This data would be critical to all, but especially the newly diagnosed who are making tough decisions about their treatment. Why does retrospective data require a formal study? It should be helpful to minimally be able to ask a clinician for broad trends on basic profiles, heavy chain, light chain, successful treatments. I fail to see why this is not only available, but also continuously updated. I go to a major cancer center and that has IT capability, but assure me that the data is not available. Well, that's a lot to to say, but Kate, it's a great question, and it's one of the reasons I started www.myelomasurvival.com. At diagnosis, I too could not understand why this stuff wasn't available, and it's still not available some 7 years later. I can only do this. I can let you know what all the doctors that I've talked with over time tell me. First and foremost, some have said it is irrelevant because we treat each patient as an individual, and so this overall data makes no difference. Another one told me we do not collect the data in this format. Additionally, some people actually send their data by law to CIR, which is the National Cancer Institute database, or to CIMBCR, which is the Myeloma Bone Cancer Research Group with 500 hospitals. But they do not know that this information, but the clinicians don't know that this information exists or do not choose to obtain it, although they can, because I know that the doctors there say they can. But again, some do. One actually told me this quote: "One of our great failings as a program is that we do not have a wonderful database. We can give you the number of patients we treat, but survival data would be harder to come by." And so with all due respect, the data is there. It's just not being mined in a way that's useful. One last point I'd like to make is that some locations do find that this is of value. They've already done as much work as they can on this. That would be Mayo, UAMS, and a few others. And they're trying to make your vision of what should be done a reality. One specifically is Dr. Hoffmeister of the James at Ohio State University. And he spent over 2 years and now well over $50,000 putting in place a computer registry for the James Hospital at the University of Ohio State University, and they plan on applying it for the entire state of Ohio. So I hope this happens. I hope Dr. Hoffmeister gets this done, and that gets this to go nationwide. But until that happens, we're going to operate with the systems that exist, and that's pretty much nothing. And we're operating basically in the dark ages. Rosalie Ramirez, she said February 18, 2013, at WWNPR.org, they talk about a new med to keep multiple myeloma in control. What is your opinion on this med? And I went and I looked up and did a search and found out that really they were talking about pomalidomide. And pomalidomide is an IMID. It's a class of drugs such as thalidomide and Revlimid. It is one of the two most recently approved drugs for relapsed and refractory myeloma, which includes another great new drug, which is carfilzomib. If you go to the Cure Panel site, you'll find recently there was a presentation by Dr. Saji Khan of Mayo and Dr. Edward Faber of the University of New Mexico University of Nevada Medical Center, I'm sorry, who explained the advantages of these drugs. And a quick summary is that these new drugs, pomalidomide and carfilzomib, they work in patients that are all where all prior approved drugs that have been used have failed. And the RVD, which is one of the best, which is Revlimid, Velcade, and dexamethasone, that combination, where they no longer work, if you just substitute carfilzomib for the Revlimid in RVD, or if you substitute the pomalidomide for the Velcade in RVD, they will work again. So it's a great thing. And when used in combination for newly diagnosed patients, the response rate has been excellent. So it's a great combination of new drugs that are on the market, and it's been 7 years since any new drugs had been approved for treatment. So it is a truly great thing for myeloma patients right now. And things just keep getting better all the time with regard to this. Sounds like a song, doesn't it? And so those are my questions, Pat. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Great. Hey, thanks, Gary. That was really comprehensive. Nick, let's move on to you. Nick, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, perfect. All right, so the ones that I've got. First is from Lorraine Jones, who asks, how long must a patient remain on Revlimid maintenance therapy?
And do the risk of side effects from Revlimid increase the longer a patient remains on the drug? Very important questions, because Revlimid has become one of the central agents used to treat myeloma, really across the spectrum of opinions, from the most conservative to the most aggressive approaches, and it's had a very meaningful, perhaps more so than any other drug, with the possible exception of Velcade, difference in the outcome in the last 10 years of patient longevity. The amount of time that you need to remain on it really depends upon the approach that you and your physician are taking in treating the disease, and it depends on how maintenance therapy fits within the context of that approach. In a more conservative approach that tries to control the disease and not necessarily use as much stuff up front against it as possible, one approach is to stay on Revlimid indefinitely until such time as either the myeloma is undetectable or the Revlimid stops to work. And I think, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, Pat, but that was the approach that you took initially, was just to do Revlimid and Dex in combination. That's certainly one approach. Another approach is to use Revlimid as maintenance after therapy. That's the approach in Arkansas. Historically, that has been done 3 years in Arkansas and 2 years elsewhere, for example, for the Huntsman Clinic in Salt Lake, and their Dr. Trico, who's moved to Iowa, I believe, will do the same thing there. It's more limited as a maintenance agent because, particularly recently, studies have shown that prolonged Revlimid use after a transplant, or specifically after the use of alkylating chemotherapy, which is chemotherapy that alters DNA, does lead to an increase in the incidence of secondary cancers. Most problematically, a condition called MDS, which is myelodysplastic syndrome, which is a precursor to leukemia. And depending upon who you talk to, that there can be, 8 to 12% of Revlimid users can develop that cancer if they're on the drug long enough. Based on conversations I've had, there is an increase in the incidence of those secondary cancers after the second year of therapy. So I would not be surprised to see Arkansas perhaps modulating down the amount of Revlimid in the third year as they continue to study this. But that's sort of for a approach that is designed to be as aggressive as possible and hopefully curative. 2 to 3 years of post-transplant maintenance on Revlimid is usually where people are coming out. So that's that one. My next question is from Sharon Pasco, with whom I empathize here. She writes, I'm going to start my stem cell transplant at UAMS on March 4th, which is this coming Monday. My body has rebelled at every turn. I'm moving forward on faith because my body is kicking and screaming. So I don't know if there's a specific question there, but it's certainly a call to help or a cry for help. I will tell you, and I think Gary will tell you this as well, it can be done. You can do this. It's hard to answer specifically your concerns because I don't know exactly where in the protocol you are, but if you're pre-transplant at UAMS, that means you've had either 1 or 2 cycle of induction therapy, and that at UAMS includes a dose of Velcade, a dose of thalidomide, which is a precursor to Revlimid. That was its, Revlimid is thalidomide's more smarter and more gentle cousin, I guess you could say, and more effective. But thalidomide is used pre-transplant in Arkansas and Revlimid post-transplant. You also get dexamethasone, and then you get, which is unique to the more aggressive approach, you get 4 mainline chemotherapy agents that used to be used in a host of cancers and still are in many cases, like lymphoma uses a lot of these. And you get those in a continuous IV over 4 days that you sort of carry around with you. Everything at UAMS is done outpatient. So the side effects from the transplant are not going to be any worse, really, than what you've already endured. In my experience, they're very good at controlling nausea. They're pretty good at controlling the infamous mouth sores that sometimes people get. And the one thing you can't really control is, pardon the expression, good old-fashioned diarrhea. You're going to get that because the melphalan in the transplant destroys the lining of your digestive system. The chemotherapy works by destroying fast-dividing cells, which include cancer, your hair follicles, and your digestive tract. And that's why you lose your taste buds, and that's why you're going to have trouble with your gastrointestinal system for a couple of weeks. But you take some Imodium and you sleep a lot. You'll be tired after the transplants, but it's very doable. In about 2 weeks afterwards, you'll start feeling much better, and you may find yourself, as was the case with me, feeling significantly better than you did pre-treatment, because after all, the cancer is creating a burden on your system, whether it be your kidneys or your blood supply or whatnot, and if you kick the cancer in the teeth, you'll start to feel a little bit better. So you can do this. You'll make it. Your body will get with the program. Keep your head in the game and keep your attitude and your faith strong and positive, and you'll manage. The third question is from Alan Spack, who writes, can an IMID drug work like thalidomide, which was very effective 10 years ago, while Revlimid was not? This is a bit of a question that a layman shouldn't try to tackle, so let me preface this by saying that I'm not a doctor, I'm just a patient. I do know that thalidomide and Revlimid work through similar but slightly different mechanisms. I've heard, at UAMS they use thalidomide pre-transplant because Revlimid suppresses platelet recovery, and after you get a transplant, your platelets bottom out along with everything else in your blood supply, and they need time to recover. And if you're on Revlimid, it slows down the rate of their recovery because Revlimid suppresses platelets. So I know that thalidomide and Revlimid work through slightly different actions. They may be effective. One may be effective when the other is not. I know that Pat mentioned Revlimid was effective for a while and then stopped working. Then his system went through a bit of a chemotherapy shock, and then the Revlimid worked again. So I would say anything's possible. Both are effective treatments for myeloma, and as is pomalidomide, the new variant of that same family of drugs. So hopefully between the three of those, you'll find good long-term effectiveness.
Thank you.
And that's it for me.
Thank you very much. Helpful.
My pleasure.
There's some knowledgeable people out there. It's wonderful. Sandy, you're on. Could you answer your questions, please?
All right. My first question is from Jim Bird, and it said, anything in regards to survivorship? That's my favorite word because that's what all myeloma patients want to experience. What I have found is a new kind of phrase for my own self, and that's the only person I can really speak for, is if I'm having a good day, do something good. In my community, and hopefully you'll look for this, all of the patients, there are many programs, even integrative medicine or integrative oncology for the cancer patients. This means everything that's not just medicine. There are exercise programs that are free to cancer patients, art classes, massage, nutrition, of course. That's the problem. You need to take advantage of everything that you can find. One of the biggest things is be part of a support group, because if you have some bad times, they'll be there to share with you their experiences. Sometimes even the Leukemia Lymphoma Society, LLS, has blood cancer support groups available in different locations, or start your own. Just if you don't have one, go to the IMS website, and they will be more than happy to help you start your own. It's not that difficult. The other thing is rest when you need to, take deep breaths, and just be grateful for every day. It seems like cancer makes you more aware of everything. You notice everything around you. You learn that you can say no when you want to say no. You don't have to just be nice to say yes all the time. And you'll find that you're your own best friend, but sometimes you can be your worst enemy. So if you don't take advantage of everything that's out there to help you be a successful survivor, it is there. You just have to look for it. And if I can be of any help to you outside of this forum, Pat Killingsworth will know how to reach me. Thank you. My next question is from Christina Steinhagen. And Christina says, I hear about other myeloma patients who are running marathons or back to work just a few months post-transplant. I am 19 months post-transplant and not taking any maintenance meds. I've not been able to return to work yet due to residual peripheral neuropathy and fatigue. I've been following diet advice regarding a healthful myeloma diet, maintaining a restful and stress-free schedule, and do not smoke or drink alcohol. I walk my dogs for 1 mile almost daily. Any other suggestions to improve stamina and or decrease peripheral neuropathy? And Christina, you are really doing a lot of right things that I wish all of us could do. But as far as stamina and PN, I'll only tell you again my experience with the stamina problem. I learned the hard way that if you're more active, you'll be more active. Sounds like you're really trying and you walk a mile and maybe you'll have to try a mile and a quarter. And it's important to keep your brain stimulated, you know, by playing games, brain games, or talking to people about subjects that are a little bit outside your knowledge or information. And again, a support group will let you vent and it gives you other patients' views. The same with peripheral neuropathy. There's a lot of info out there, but each person reacts differently. If it were me, I would try the many various remedies that are not of a medical nature. They won't hurt. Just give them a chance. Even if it's ivory soap under the sheets at your feet or rolling your feet on golf balls, or a good one really is warm paraffin wax on your hands or feet and wrap them up and let the warmth sink in. You can get a paraffin bath at Bed Bath & Beyond pretty reasonably. Also, I know this, nerves are weird things, and their response to medication can vary even from day to day. I am really sorry for your pain, but hopefully a remedy will be coming soon. Maybe the doctors just need to work a little harder on that one. Let's go to my next question, which is from Michael Gabriel. And Michael writes, maintenance drug combos and dosages following VRD and ASCT, skin rash, peeling, dryness. Could this be side effects of 15 milligrams of Revlimid, neuropathy, any supplements or recommendations currently on Lyrica? So I kind of answered the peripheral neuropathy with the last question. And as far as the rashes go, yes, sir. 15 milligrams of Revlimid certainly can cause rashes. I had one. I had it all over my body. But the thing was that I kept talking to my oncologist. What is this from? What can I do? And I didn't think about, and obviously he didn't either, why don't you go to a dermatologist? They are skin specialists, and they can talk with your oncologist, but the dermatologists have access to creams and lotions that other doctors don't even know about. So you make sure that you tell the dermatologist about your multiple myeloma and all your treatments, or better yet, have him call your oncologist to confirm that treatment. And as I discussed earlier about PN, medications are different for each person. Dealing with nerve pain, it's sometimes indescribable to say how it feels, and I guess it's just hit or miss to find a solution. There's just not one thing that works for everybody. And also, there was a question at the very end by Teresa Bethea, who I've met. And Teresa, I hope all of this answered your question about the side effects from Revlimid also. Thank you, Pat. I've finished now.
Well, thank you. It doesn't get any better than that. Appreciate it, Sandy. What I'd like to do, and you're right, there were some questions that came in late. But Priya, let's go to the phones, because although I do understand we can run as much as 10 minutes over, which we might need, but let's get some callers in. I know it gets a little awkward, but we'll figure it out. Let's try the phones, Priya.
Yeah. Callers, you can just press 1 if you have a question for our panel. callers can press 1 and we'll bring you live to ask your question. The caller calling from 310271, please ask your question.
Oh, hi, this is Jason calling from Santa Monica, California. I'm curious what experience the panel members have had with infection. I'm actually currently still in a smoldering phase, but I do occasionally, because of some of my counts, get different types of infections. The latest one was a pretty serious ear infection from swimming. And just looking down the road, I'm very concerned about, particularly once, you know, treatment starts, how I'm ever basically going to be able to avoid getting recurrent infections of various types. So I'm curious how you've all dealt with that. Thanks.
That's a great question. I'm thinking Gary or Nick, one of you want to step in?
I'll do that if you don't mind. Jason, this is Gary Peterson. Generally, if you're a myeloma specialist, okay, if you're going through stem cell transplant or if that happens to be part of your program in the future, is that when you do that, they'll usually give you 3 different drugs during that time when you're very, you know, you're very susceptible to infection. So they'll cover that time during the intense part of your therapy. They'll give you an antibiotic, an antiviral, and an antifungal. So effectively what they're doing, because when they kill your bone marrow or when it's under attack by these drugs in order to bring the disease under control, you know, you will become a neutropenic is what they call it, or near neutropenic, which means that you don't have much of an infection fighting response. And as a result, you're susceptible to disease, so you need these things to help you out. What I've done even since then is that, you know, what happens to me, and it's happened twice, I've had pneumonia, and because to me, your immune system is so, it is depressed, and as a result, it doesn't respond. And one of the ways that it responds is that it'll raise your temperature. So your temperature doesn't, I don't believe, you know, rises until you've got a tremendous burden, a disease burden. So as your temperature goes up, where you might have thought, well, 102 is bad, now you should say, you know, 100 is bad. And go to a doctor. So you want to be very quick for treatment. What I've done is anytime I go someplace, I'll have an antibiotic that I've got with me. I have an antiviral with me as well. And as soon as I feel bad, I start taking that antiviral. And as soon as I even touch a temperature, I start taking an antibiotic. So, you know, it's really, you know, better to be safe than to be sorry. And once I, you know, tried to rough it, and I told my wife, I said, I'm okay, I just got a little fever. And, you know, 4 hours later, I was in the emergency room, and I had gone septic. And if you go septic, you've got about a 60 or 70%, or probably a 30 or 40% chance of making it. So you just don't mess with this stuff. You keep on top of it. I guess that's the best I can say with regard to that. I hope that
helps
you out, Jason.
Thank you. And I'm not sure, I just wanted to add, I'm not sure the physiological reasons, unless some MGUS people might have compromised bone marrow with some low counts. But I just wanted to add that this is not unusual. I hear from MGUS people a lot in smoldering patients that have repeat infections, and I would, you know, I would dig till I get some answers, and dig till I find some ways to help get these things taken care of, even if that means a second opinion. So thanks for your question. Next, Priya.
Yeah. The caller from 757495, please ask a question. The caller calling from 757495, Please ask your question.
Yes, this is Christine from Virginia. Thank you, Ms. Hirsch, for your answer regarding stamina and peripheral neuropathy. I had a question for those that did receive Velcade. Did you receive twice weekly Velcade in your cycles, or did you receive subcutaneous or once weekly? I was just wondering. I had such difficulty with Velcade, with hypotension, and with the peripheral neuropathy.
Sandy, how often do you get your Velcade?
As soon as it came out, sub-Q, went to sub-Q, and from everybody I've heard from in the support group and around everywhere, the sub-Q has been extremely successful in reducing hypotension and also peripheral neuropathy.
And I might add that once a week, more and more myeloma docs are going to once a week administration instead of the two times for the first 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Pat, I think we have... Thank you. Pat, I think we have time to go through the last few questions, maybe 3-4 minutes.
Okay. The questions that were sent in?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. Quickly, Carol asks about, are there ways to raise your neutrophils? And the doctors always tell me no. You know, of course, you take, you get a shot of Neupogen. Well, you'd think there should be some way to do that. And interesting enough, we just had an acupuncturist come to our support group. And through a combination of herbs, of course, check with your oncologist, get a list, a combination of herbs and acupuncture, he's been able to significantly help raise people's ANC count. And I was fascinated by that. Isn't just another reason to attend a support group, I guess, and have a wide variety of speakers. Carol, I've met Carol. Carol Teague, she wonders about the effects of DEX on eyes and vision, and she's having some real problems with that. Sandy, do you have anybody in your support group having problems with DEX and vision?
I have had a few people that have had cataract surgery. Can I say it's just the DEX? I don't really know. And I'm not sure they know for sure because they were always on another drug with the DEX. But, yes, I have heard of this before. And does it go away after you finish DEX? You know, that's not an answer I have.
Well, Pat, I did have cataract surgery. This is Gary Peterson. And, you know, the doctors had at Mayo, and I had thought that it was a result of the DEX that I had taken over a number of years. And it's not, and once you've had it with DEX, it's not reversible. So you'll need cataract surgery at some point in time.
Nick, one of my regular readers, David Baker, talks about a rash he's had with Revlimid. Do you have any experience with that? Have you had the rash, or do you know anybody there?
I had...
Go ahead.
First of all, am I muted or can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. I can hear you.
All right. So when I was on thalidomide, I had I don't know if you can call it a rash, but it was like a swelling in my temple on the side of my face, which I discontinued. Oddly enough, the usual treatment for that is more DEX to suppress the inflammation. But on Revlimid, I didn't have a rash like that per se, but I did have... And I think this is just a function of a suppressed immune system post-transplant. You're sort of relearning all of your childhood immunities to some degrees. And I got what ultimately was diagnosed as hand, foot, and mouth disease, not to be confused with hoof and mouth disease, which I might also get one of these days. And that presented as a rash on my fingertips. So I know that skin conditions while on Revlimid are not terribly uncommon, but I would keep a close look at it. I would see... a dermatologist, potentially, if you think there's an issue there, but I'd also see a myeloma specialist because a derm is not necessarily going to know what to look for in an immune system depressed patient.
Thanks. And quickly, if we have time, do you see, Nick, can you read Rosalind's question about or do we need to cut it off, Priya?
Yeah, Pat, we're coming to the end of our show time, Pat. We are finished almost 1 hour now. Pat, it was a wonderful discussion. Thank you so very much. Gary, Nick, and Sandy, it was great having you on the Cure Panel Talk Show. Thank you very much. CureTalk thanks all its listeners and participants. Thank you all for your support, and we look forward to having all of you join us for the next Cure Panel Talk Show on March 20th. Please visit trilex.com/curetalk for further information, and MMRF website myelomatrilex.com or trilex.com/ask for information regarding clinical trials. Thank you very much. Thank you all. It was great having you here.
Good night.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you for giving your time.
Thank you.
Rosalind, you'll be fine. Bye-bye.